Les colloques du Collège de France.
Before I start, I wanted to thank once again Samantha Besson for this invitation to this extremely interesting colloquium, and thank you to the panelists for the presentations that show that the current context is particularly stimulating, fascinating, and unfortunately often discouraging for international lawyers. What happens nowadays in space, but also as we saw in the law of the sea, challenges the public international law as we know it. It challenges its sources, the treaties, custom, unilateral acts, but also its subjects, states, international organization, and increasing role of private entities and indigenous people. I will be making six different remarks that, in my view, arise from all the contribution as the six common trends. The first one, and the easiest one, is that the issues we have been discussing today are not specific to space law. What really struck me when I was reading the papers and while listening today to the presentations this morning and this afternoon is the absolute similarity with my own domain of expertise, the law of the sea, and more particularly, the deep sea mining in the area. The majority of our panelists' conclusions could apply mutatis mutandis to what I work on as a law of the sea scholar and as a member of the Legal and Technical Commission of the International Seabed Authority. The contributors also drew several parallels with deep sea mining. So from the deepest below the surface of the sea to the furthest in outer space, from nadir to zenith, nothing could be further apart distance-wise and simultaneously more close as a context. So one can inspire and influence the other as they have been doing all along. The similarities are multiple. Of course, similar challenges, of course, similar stakeholders, and even, and this is maybe more remarkable, similar polarization. US on the one hand, Russia, China, and many developing states on the other hand. There is, however, legally, one very important difference concerning the subject matter of this colloquium. Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty leaves more margin to interpretation than UNCLOS, United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Whereas it is not specified in Article 2 that resources extracted from a celestial body are also not subject to appropriation, Article 137, paragraph 2 of Part 11 of UNCLOS, as Alex Mills also reminded this morning, specifies, and I quote, "All rights in the resources of the area as vested in mankind as a whole, on whose behalf the authorities shall act. These resources are not subject to alienation. The minerals recovered from the area, however, may only be alienated in accordance with this part and the rules, regulations, and procedures of the authority. Thus, a more certain and clearer regime is provided for, at least for the state parties. Such a regime could be an inspiration for space law, as Article 11 of the Moon Agreement shows. In both cases, the legal, not the ethical, the legal question is not so much if exploitation as such is lawful under current positive law, since UNCLOS provides for it and COPOS, as Philippe Achilles argued, seems to take it as a given, but under which conditions and thus when in time would such exploitation be in conformity with current public international law. Any claims for moratorium, for precautionary pause, and a fortiori for multilateral governance must be understood in this context. Of course, Article 137, paragraph 2, underlines the importance of an international multilateral governance institution, which leads me to the second point, the need for an institutional incarnation for the regime of common heritage of mankind. Such a regime of a positive internationalization cannot be efficient without a centralized governance. For the area, we have the International Seabed Authority. Isabel argued that this is not enough, but I would argue that at least it is necessary. And I will be happy to discuss how the contracts between the International Seabed Authority and the contractors respect the concept of the common heritage of mankind. In any case, there is no equivalent for the outer space and its resources. However, even when such centralization does exist, the current situation shows that if powerful states are not parties to the relative international organization and treaties, and or if powerful states choose to bypass them, the dead end is still very possible. The Working Group on Legal Aspects of Space Resource Activities at COPIUS mandate includes, as you said, studying the existing legal framework, assessing the benefits of further development of a framework for resource utilization activities, including by way of additional international governance instruments. Professor Bayer stated in his paper that this is the first time since the 70s that member states of COPIUS have been willing to consider a new international governance instrument beyond non-binding principles and recommendations. But both Professors Byers and Professor Akileas argued that this is highly unlikely. Philippe Akileas regretted that the 2025 updated initial draft set for recommended principle for space resources activities falls short of the ambitious common heritage of mankind regime, which is with its promise of mandatory benefit sharing and centralized management. In the context of outer space, with no global centralized governance, Professor Byers asks, will enough non-spacefaring states, individually and collectively, find the political will to stand up to the United States and its strategic divide and conquer approach? We can ask the exact same questions in the exact same terms for deep seabed mining. As you know, US are not party to UNCLOS, even though they did sign but not ratified the 1994 agreement. So, unless Part 11 of UNCLOS in its entirety is considered to have crystallized into customary law, which the US deny, different interpretation of the regime of common heritage of mankind are still possible. And the US relies heavily on this to try and bypass the reality of multilateral governance of the area and its resources on the one hand, and the perspective of such a governance in outer space on the other hand. Which leads me to the third point. It's striking in all the contribution, the great schism between the multilateral logic and the unilateral logic. We have recurrent themes, multilateralism versus unilateralism, ultra-liberal global order versus common interests, commercial exploitation versus or taking into account common heritage of mankind. Whereas international instruments exist, and whereas for the area an institutional incarnation also exists, unilateralism thrives. We can draw very easily a parallel with, on the one hand, the US Commercial Space Launch Competitiveness Act of 2015, as combined with the recent executive order of August 2025, which, as Isabel Freitner explained in her paper, directs government agencies to enable a competitive launch marketplace, inter alia, by eliminating or expediting environmental reviews and other obstacles to the granting of launch and re-entry licenses and permits. So, a parallel between this, on the one hand, and on the other hand, Trump's executive decree of April 2025, which made our work so much harder because he decided to allow for licensing for deep seabed mining under the Deep Seabed Hard Minerals Resources Act. This decree explicitly mentions competition with China as rationale of its adoption. In a context where legitimate environmental concerns are central in the International Seabed Authority deadlock, such unilateral government initiatives, combined with companies such as the Metals Company, with little scruples, pose a big threat to the multilateral governance of the law of the sea. And of course, you probably know that TMC USA has already applied for the first time in history for an exploitation license under the US regime. Another parallel a lot of panelists drew together today was Artemis Accords and their equivalent in law of the sea, reciprocating state regime in the 80s, which was abandoned since in the profit of UNCLOS Part 11 as modified by the 1994 agreement. Both those strategies, Artemis Accords and reciprocating state regime, are based on a unilateral initiative and on an individualistic negative internationalization logic. So a logic where the limit of the traditional freedom for each state, it's only the freedom of the other state and nothing more. They are not based on a multilateral governance and on a commoning positive internationalization logic. So a logic where the limit for the traditional freedom is no longer only individualistic interest, but also the interest of humanity as a whole. In both cases, the actual legal question is what the qualifications of province of mankind and of common heritage of mankind entail, as you also said. And whereas this regime would be binding to non-state parties. In my opinion, a regime of positive internationalization can be considered in both cases, certainly for the area and most probably for outer space, to be customary. Even if other details of Part 11 of UNCLOS and the details of the Moon Agreement are not, even if, which I'm not saying they're not, but even if. However, the US denies this customary nature for the area. I unfortunately do not have the time to develop any arguments, but I strongly believe it can be shown that the US have accepted the qualification as customary on several occasions and are not a persistent objector. For space law, as Isabel Frechtner mentioned in her paper, on April 2020, US President Donald Trump issued an executive order stating that the US did not view outer space as a global commons, that the Moon Agreement was neither effective nor necessary, and that the US objected to attempts at treating its content as customary international law. In my humble opinion, at the very least, the qualification province of mankind of Outer Space Treaty and Article 136 on Common Heritage of Mankind of UNCLOS are customary. One can argue that the exclusive mandate of the International Seabed Authority is not customary. But this does not mean that the qualification of the area as common heritage of mankind, also accepted as such by the USA for a very long time, is not. So if we accept that, such a regime imposes, as a limit to the traditional freedom of res communis, at least three things. One, some kind of multilateral cooperation. Two, respect of some environmental and sustainability principles. Three, equitable sharing of benefits if exploitation takes place, even if not within the exclusive mandate of the ASA for the area, and even if not yet set out for the outer space. If we accept that, any purely unilateral action should be considered contrary to public international law. It is one thing to say that the Outer Space Treaty does not address the issue of property rights over extracted space resources. I agree with that. But it's a whole other thing to consider that the Outer Space Treaty authorizes unilateral, private or national, unregulated appropriation of those resources. Not only the Lotus Principle, according to which what is not prohibited in public international law is authorized, has since been toned down, but also the Common Heritage of Mankind regime must have some inherent legal implications which differentiate the freedom of high seas, so the negative internationalization, from the regime of the area, which is a positive internationalization. The three points that are left are very, very brief. Bear with me, please. So the fourth point is the importance of the historical, geopolitical, and technological contexts. The time of the adoption of the treaties versus nowadays. Those treaties were negotiated and adopted decades ago, but they apply now or even in the future, since neither exploitation has begun. So it has been shown by a lot of contributors today, Samantha Besson, first of them, the importance of the Cold War as context of the adoption, so the polarization between the USA and the Soviet Union. And since then, we have to underline the importance of technological evolutions, since at the time that those treaties were negotiated, nothing of what we can imagine now seemed possible, either exploitation in the deep sea or exploitation in the outer space. So what was not feasible then is now possible. And of course, the importance of new issues that were not central at the time, environmental questions and sustainability questions. Mr. Byers quotes in his article the travaux préparatoires of the Outer Space Treaty and a comment from the Soviet Union representative. I quote, "Needless to say, a treaty could deal only with the problems arising at the current stage of human evolution. Future developments would give rise to new problems requiring subsequent solutions." It is exactly what happened with both the deep sea mining and the space mining questions. Fifth, this shows the need for new instruments, but also from some kind of multilateral, if not universal, adherence to them. Also here, a very important parallel. We have the draft set of recommended principles for space resource activities in front of COPROS, and at the same time, the negotiation before the International Seabed Authority of the mining code with all its standards and guidelines. These are parallel processes of great importance. Of course, the mining code is negotiated without the US, who are not party to the International Seabed Authority. Let me tell you, though, that until the April 2025 executive decree, the US as an observant state were not only always present, but also very active with the negotiations. As COPROS operate on the basis of consensus, any single state can block not just the adoption of principles, but any of the many steps necessary to get there. Mutatis mutandis, in the International Seabed Authority, the idea is that nothing is adopted in the mining code unless everything is adopted. So for both those new instruments, it is very difficult to adopt them, given the polarization between the different stakeholders. Last but not least, sixth point, the importance of non-state actors and the implications for public international law in general and for our subject matter in particular. Of course, the first private stakeholder that comes into mind are companies. You all talked about the new space movement, so private companies such as SpaceX, Planetary Resources Inc., Deep State Industries are central to the space mining questions. In parallel, in the deep sea mining questions, you have private contractors playing a very important role, with the metals company as the one who comes challenge the multilateral governance such as we know it. Isabel Freitner mentioned in her paper the Planetary Resources Inc. and Deep Space Industries that had sought to attract investors with the prospects of incredible wealth from space mining. Exactly the same happened. The same thing happened with the metals company and all of its subsidiaries, which attract investors with the same promise. And the metals company stock saw a huge gain this year, more than 286%. The metals company, through its subsidiaries, hold several contracts with the International Seabed Authority, having small Pacific islands as sponsoring states. Of course, Nauru, everybody knows about Nauru, but also Tonga, and up until recently, Kiribati. Impossible Metals have just applied for a new contract with Bahrain as sponsoring state. All this private activity, of course, raises questions of responsibility and liability. The direct attribution of private actors' activities to national states as a derogation of state responsibility common regime for the outer space has not been duplicated in the law of the sea. So the sponsoring states in the area are said in the advisory opinion of the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea of 2011 to only have obligations of due diligence. Last, another private actor that I'm very thankful to Isabel to have talked about, because we often forget them, indigenous people. Of course, in the Law of the Sea, we have been talking a lot about their role, very active role for the BBNJ biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction adoption, the new treaty on the high seas, but also for the question of deep seabed mining in the International Seabed Authority, and maybe less known for space law. So you stated that indigenous peoples are intervening in the debate about the future law of the ocean and outer space. Which leads me to the beginning, and this will be the end. We can see with these six common points to all the contributions that the current context actually challenges the very core of public international law, its sources and its subjects as we know them. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site. Collège-2-France.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.